the Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
You're tuned in to the R1 News, your stop for news and current affairs on the airwaves. 11 to 12 weekdays here on Radio 1 91 FM. Te reo irirangi kotahi.
Tēnā koutou I tēnei ata. Kei te whakarunga mai koe ki te reo irirangi kotahi. Ko Zach toku ingoa.
Ko Emilia toku ingoa.
And you're listening to the R1 News Show for Ramere, Te Tekau Maorima o Hongongoi on Radio 1 Te Reo, Irirangi Kotahi.
Coming up on the program, I tēnei rā, Trent Smith from the University of Otago Department of Economics is coming on to discuss market barriers in our weekly segment, Business as Usual. Then, we'll be speaking with New Zealand Education Institute President Liam Rutherford about the COVID-imposed problems facing the primary schools and their teachers. Following this, we'll hear from CEO of the Pacific Sexual and Gender Diversity Network about the latest bid in the Cook Islands to decriminalise same-sex relations.
Very shortly, we'll have Dave Borry coming on to do news and weather. But first, here's Shout Out by the Walker Brothers. You're listening to the R1 News on Te Reo, Irirangi Kotahi. Puritia kia raka.
Kia ora koutou katoa, you're listening to the Ramere R1 News Show here on Radio 1 Te Reo, Irirangi Kotahi. It is currently 11:05. That was the Walker Brothers with Shut Out. Now we have the news and weather updates from none other than Mr. Dave Borry himself.
The R1 News Headlines.
Tēnā koutou, ko Dave aho. Police are treating the death of a man reportedly assaulted and run over with a car in Dunedin last night as unexplained. Emergency services were called to Eglinton Road, Mornington, at about 7:30pm on Thursday after reports of a man being run over by a vehicle. Paramedics attempted to revive the man, who died at the scene. Police have not commented on their knowledge of the driver or other occupants of the car, but say a group of people were present prior to the man's death. scene examination is continuing, and police want to hear from anyone who may have witnessed the event. The government is recommending schools enforce a mask-wearing policy for students in Year 4 and above, ahead of the start of Term 3 on Monday. A letter from Associate Minister Jan Tinetti to school boards has outlined the government's, quote, strong recommendation to review and enforce a mask-wearing policy as much as practicable. Practicable. A similar policy was in place earlier in the year, but the government shifted to encouraging, rather than mandating, mask-wearing in schools in April. This move was heavily criticised by epidemiologists and health experts. More than 125,000 travellers have had travel plans disrupted as Air New Zealand cancels 181 flights. Extreme weather, particularly in Te Whanganui Atara, Wellington, saw all flights in and out of the city cancelled yesterday, with more cancellations this morning, though flights are now operating on schedule. Air New Zealand CEO Greg Foran said it would take days to clear the backlog and encouraged those with non-urgent travel needs to consider taking a credit on their flights rather than waiting to be rebooked. And those were the headlines on R1 News. Now, kei te pehe te ahua o te rangi. How's the weather?
The R1 News weather.
E tēnei rā, Otipoti can expect occasional showers with southwesterlies dying out in the afternoon. Partially cloud and a high of Waru, 8, with a low of Rima, 5. Apōpō, expect a high of Iwa, 9, and a low of Toru, 3, with drizzle overnight and in the morning, clearing to a fine afternoon.
That was the R1 News headlines. Catch up at r1.co.nz/news or find us at Radio 1 91 FM on Twitter or R1 News NZ on Instagram, and tune in to R1 News at 11 a.m. on weekdays.
Just a quick truth to Dave Borrow for reading those excellent news and weather updates. It's currently 11:08 here on the Ramere R1 News program on Radio 1. Up next we have Trent Smith from University of Otago joining us to talk about market barriers and our weekly economic segment, Business as Usual. But first, we have to get through a tune. Here is Timeless by James Blake. Keep it locked. Kia ora koutou katoa, you're listening to Radio 1 Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. This is the Rāmere A1 News Show. It's currently 11:13. That was James Blake with Timeless.
Now we are joined by Trent Smith from the University of Otago's Department of Economics for this week's instalment of Business as Usual. In today's edition, we're going to be talking about market barriers. Barriers in a market work to limit competition in that sector. They can be things like high startup costs, regulatory requirements, or even obstacles constructed by existing competitors in the industry. Kia ora, Trent. How are you going today?
Hey, Miria. I'm fine, thanks. Kia ora, Zach.
Kia ora.
So to start off with, we were just curious as to how market barriers come about. Like, are they naturally occurring or...?
Market barriers are kind of a theoretical construct, right? So if you're asking for real-world examples, there are millions, right? Yeah, so there are lots of all sorts of frictions in the marketplace that, keep a new business from popping up here and there. But they are often strategically created by the existing industry, right? Of course. Anti-competitive behavior is pretty easy to find if you look for it. But there's this larger question of, what's wrong with having a monopoly? What's wrong with having big producers? It's actually a pretty complicated thing. When we teach first year economics, sort of the simple story is that, if you have a big monopoly, they're going to raise prices because they're a monopoly. But in practice, a lot of monopolies actually result in lower prices, right? Like a big chain store invests in a big distribution network, suddenly they can deliver goods at lower cost. And that's kind of how they gain their monopoly, right? No one else can compete with their low-cost delivery networks. But there's a pretty long list of other things that, so that's counterintuitive, right? It's the opposite of what we teach in first year, that monopoly lowers prices. There's a pretty long list of other problems that get created, though, right? You can have, these big, powerful players, supermarkets and so forth, influencing political decisions. They could be bullying their suppliers. This is a big problem. When you get a big company, they can sort of destroy their suppliers, essentially, or strip all the profits away from their suppliers. So it's a fun topic.
It certainly does sound like a fun topic. When would you say entry barriers are beneficial? Of course, for something like the arms trade, that would be a very beneficial time because you don't want everyone being able to make arms and trading them to certain nation states. But aside from that, when would you say market barriers could be beneficial?
That's a good question. Yeah. So the example I just gave, right? If you have a big, chain store, supermarkets or hardware, whatever it might be, it may actually be more efficient to just have one of those, right? So New Zealand as a country might just decide, rather than having 10,000 grocery stores, it's more efficient to have a big distribution network, run as a supermarket chain. In that example, the barrier is kind of creating itself. This happens all over the world, right? The chain store problem. Another example might be spatial problems, right? So if Dunedin was a little bit smaller, we might decide that, two supermarkets is too much for us, right? It's sort of a waste of space. And so, space is a scarce thing in any city environment. The economics of cities is actually really complicated, but it really makes you realize that it's really hard to imagine that markets are going to get this right? Like how we use this scarce resource of space as a community.
Mm. On that note, how do barriers to entry interact with an effective competitive market?
So economists love to get their ire up about anti-competitive behavior, right? And almost everyone does that, right? If you see an example of sort of the big bully on the block, squashing under their thumb the local competition, it just seems unfair, right? And so for that reason alone, we might want to discourage this or make it illegal, right? For anti-competitive behavior to happen. And there are a lot of forms it can take. It can be lobbying to affect regulations that prevent competitors from entering, corrupting the local council, or you know, doing things with advertising that you know, that maybe rather than promoting your own product, you're attacking the competitor, that sort of thing.
So would you say it's very crucial to have a I guess a competitive market at all?
Well, I'm an economist, so of course I'm going to say competitive markets are beautiful, right? And honestly, they kind of are. You know, it's sort of the old story of Adam Smith's invisible hand, right? That if you just step back and let people choose for themselves, right? Let consumers choose what's best for themselves. Let firms sort of compete to deliver to the consumers. It's a beautiful story, and there's a lot of truth to it. But it really, it can go wrong, right? I spend a lot of my time thinking about market failures and the ways that markets can go wrong. But once you appreciate, like, what a beautiful thing this sort of, this, you know, invisible hand story is, that it really makes you want to, it makes me want to think about the market failure problems and figure out ways to fix them, right? Make markets work well. That's what keeps them beautiful, right?
Recent legislation has banned supermarket cuvettes. sorry.
Oh, my gosh.
So previously, supermarkets like Countdown had cuvettes in their leases such that if their landlords allowed competing businesses like those who also sold food or drink to open in the same development, the supermarket would only pay half of its rent. Is this common to see big companies dominating their leases and other business agreements like that?
Well, I don't know specifically about leases. I mean, it sounds terrible, right? That I'm a big supermarket, and I happen to have a big landlord who controls other, you know, spaces that could potentially house supermarkets, and so I negotiate this deal whereby no more supermarkets come into the neighborhood. So I know, for example, Consumer NZ has done reporting recently about the way that supermarkets bully their suppliers, like I mentioned earlier, right? Like they'll sort of put undue the supermarket will often be the biggest buyer for these little agricultural suppliers, and they'll sort of put pressure on them not to sell to the competition or not to sell at a lower price and this sort of thing. You know, there's documented reporting on this now. But, you know, yeah, on the other hand, you know, I mentioned the spatial problem earlier. Like, maybe, as a society, maybe it doesn't make sense to have two giant supermarkets in the same building, right? That suddenly both those spaces are going to be used a little bit less efficiently. So, you know, like I say, it's complicated, but it's definitely something that people should be talking about, right? I mean, we as a, you know, we here in Dunedin, we as a city should be, you know, helping to decide these things.
Would you say that this law will make a positive or negative difference or difference at all to the highly competitive nature of the supermarket industry?
The lease rule as a thing by itself is pretty small, right? It does make sense that you shouldn't allow this. It really does sound like bad behavior, right?
Yeah.
To lock people out, lock the competitors out of real estate. So in the overall sort of scheme of what we're going to do about our supermarket industry, it's probably a pretty small piece, right? There are bigger issues to deal with, and I hope we do.
And do you have any kind of solutions as to what could be done?
Maybe? Well, I mean, so there's been talk of sort of nationalizing grocery somehow, right? So I think Labor was talking about this in the campaign, is sort of, maybe instead of having these our duopoly of supermarkets that we have now, maybe instead we should just establish a government-run, you know, I guess it would essentially be a wholesale distribution network that any competitor, large or small, could access. And it kind of sounds crazy when you first say that, like, oh, we're going to be whatever, you know, Soviet Russia, but there's some real logic to it, and so. And there are potentially ways that you could do it efficiently, right? So you could, for example, just require distribution network to be public access in some sense, right? So I know in the U.S. there are some what they call common carrier laws, where, like, if you're going to be in the shipping industry, you have to ship for all comers at the same price, right? You can't give bulk discounts to the big the big shippers and so forth.
You can't get special treatment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Oh, that's very fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on to talk about this topic of market barriers. So it's very fascinating. Maybe next week we can talk about the economics of state-run industries. It could be very fascinating. It could be very groovy. All right, thank you so much, Trent. Oh, there we go. All right, that was Trent Smith from the University of Otago's Department of Economics talking about market barriers and their associated impact on the economy. Up next on the program, we have an interview with New Zealand Education Institute President Liam Rutherford about COVID in primary schools. But before that, we've got to get through a track. So here's Japanese Breakfast with Be Sweet. You're listening to The One. Take care.
This is the R1 News on Radio 1 91 FM. Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.
Deep, deep down.
That was Mike Patton with Deep Down, before which we were speaking with Trent Smith from the University of Otago's Department of Economics about barriers in the market. It is 11:30 a.m. and you're listening to R1 News here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. And now we're going to be speaking with President of the New Zealand Education Institute, Liam Rutherford, about the second wave of COVID in primary schools.
Now, although COVID updates aren't as widespread or accessible anymore, that doesn't mean the virus has gone away. There are currently over 60,000 reported cases in Aotearoa, with the real number expected to be much higher. Primary and secondary schools here in Aotearoa are particularly feeling the squeeze of the second wave, as staff shortages, high student absence rates, and the mass spread of sickness sweeps through the schools. Joining me to talk about how the second wave is disrupting schools is New Zealand Educational Institute Liam Rutherford. Kia ora, Liam. How are you going? Now, how have teachers found teaching at orange level compared to teaching at red? Is there much of a practical difference at all?
Yeah, I think probably the big thing that teachers are grappling with is that at a kind of wider society level, people are kind of acting as if COVID is something that we dealt with last year. But it's actually our schools that are still dealing with COVID day to day, and so when we were under red, it felt as if all of the community was behind the fact that COVID was priority number one. Whereas in orange, the feeling is that people are starting to get on with things, but schools are the ones that are still in the front line dealing with COVID.
Right, so it's kind of a case of cultural amnesia, almost, as we're like, as well in the first year of the COVID lockdown, you know, there was all the emphasis on essential workers, and that essentially went away as well, after COVID went away.
Yeah, that's right, and so with that, you start to see some behaviours creeping in where people aren't sticking to the expectations around testing at the right times, the kind of sensitivity around mask wearing. There's even examples of where kids are coming to school with symptoms. Whereas back when we were in red, there was pretty much zero tolerance for that type of stuff. And schools are the ones that are having to grapple with that very much in a day-to-day context. Mm. And they're having to do that at a time where staff numbers themselves are incredibly stretched. And so, schools are still very much on the forefront of COVID.
Yeah, now speaking of staff shortages, the primary school sector is facing drastic staff shortages at the moment. This morning I was reading a story about a retired teacher in Auckland who had to travel 200 kilometres because they've been put in placement somewhere else. Are these shortages expected to worsen under the second wave that we're going through at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, coupled with that is that we are heading into winter, which is where we normally get flu season as well. The reliever pool themselves, which is shown consistently through COVID to be vital, is massively depleted. And so schools are dealing with the day-to-day reality of splitting class numbers or rostering home year groups, just some of these kind of temporary measures to be able to manage through. But I think as we're heading back into Term 3 at the start of next week, people are preparing themselves for a rocky couple of weeks at least.
Yeah, I bet. Principals Federation President Cherie Taylor-Patel says that schools need better communication from the Ministry of Education about what schools should do if a COVID outbreak hits their school. Do you agree with Patel? And what solutions is NZEI advocating for a scenario like this?
Yeah, so what we have seen through the COVID response is that the Ministry's shown that they're willing to work with the sector in ways that we haven't traditionally seen, and so that's been really encouraging to see the close working relationship between them and the unions. Communication is an ongoing issue with the entire way that our system is set up because we treat schools as individual entities. And so what we now are seeing in this next phase of COVID is that not all schools are in the same boat at the same time because schools are dealing with waves of COVID at different levels, which makes communicating one consistent message really hard because there's times where COVID isn't really relevant to you, and then there's other parts of the country where they're not quite at the top of that wave. And so I think COVID has been one of those issues that has continued to shine the light on issues that we do have in the education sector that were there before COVID, but that obviously COVID's made worse.
Exacerbated them, so to speak.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, the government quite recently just announced that they'll be mandating mask wearing in schools for year four and beyond. I bet that this will be a welcome change for NZEI, but was there any indication something like this was down the line?
Sorry, can you say it again?
Oh, the government, they quite recently announced, I'm quite sure about this, that they'll be requiring mask wearing in schools for year four and beyond. Now, this would be a welcome change for NZEI, no doubt. But was this indicated at all? Was this communicated at all?
Yeah, the mask wearing is a double-edged sword because of the fact that schools are going to go through different periods of intensity at different times. I think people always enjoy the times where the decision is taken out of their hands. That was certainly a lot of the feedback that was coming through the mask mandate part. But at the same time, making sure that people have got the tools available to them at the right stage of COVID, I think is what schools are really after. And that's where we have had schools take the lead in saying that given case numbers, mask mandates are coming in for the next 4 weeks. What we are seeing is that communities have been really supportive of that.
Do you think that this mask mandate will do enough to slow down the virus during the second wave in schools?
I'm just not an expert in the science. What we do know is that masks play a really important role in the way that we do come out of this. I think one of the things that we're constantly having to get our head around is that it just seems like it is wave after wave after wave, and that the reality is that we're going to be dealing with COVID potentially for a number of years. And so we need to make sure that we've got tools like mask mandates in parts of the country at times when you need them, because I think that's going to be the reality for the next couple of years at least.
Yeah, it probably will be. Given that that's the case and the issues that primary schools are facing at the moment, what would NZEI want the government to do to improve the welfare for teachers and school pupils while Aotearoa is facing a cruel winter alongside two highly infectious and often debilitating respiratory viruses?
Yeah, I think that is a really good question. One thing the government has done in recent months and last year is set aside funding that schools are able to apply for to develop solutions that make sense in their context. That's gone down really well, and we've seen some really cool local initiatives come out of it. But I think the piece that's missing in that is the overarching long-term plan for how we're going to make sure that we have the right amount of staffing in primary schools. Pōaotanga was an independent review of the primary sector that was completed last year. That was really critical of the huge gap that we've got between what schools need and what the government currently provides. And we've currently got teachers and principals in primary schools negotiating collective agreements. And what teachers and principals are calling out for is that long-term plan for staffing so that there is some kind of light at the end of the tunnel around confidence that over the next 1, 3, 10 years, we're going to have enough teachers in schools to be able to deal with the workload and the level of student need that we've got. And while that's not going to happen overnight, it is so much easier to go into your job and pick yourself up to deal with the day-to-day battles of COVID when you know that the government is backing you over the long term, making sure you've got the resources that you need.
That was a fantastic answer. Thank you so much, Liam. Oh, my gosh. The need for more teachers in the long term sounds like it'd be a separate conversation, but thank you so much for your time today. It's been really nice speaking with you.
Likewise.
Cool. Take care. That was Liam Rutherford, the president of the New Zealand Educational Institute, speaking on the issues facing primary schools around COVID and the second wave. Coming up on the program, we have a story about the political will to decriminalise same-sex relations in the Cook Islands. It's currently 11:39 on the Ramere Awan News program. Coming up now, on tune-wise at least, we have Metaphysical, A Good Day by Handsome Boy Modelling School. Puritia kia raka.
Style. M-A-H-O. Metaphysical style. With the good day style.
Hypothesis, scientific parabolas, my linear projectile puncture, chronic. navigation, symmetry couple yeah. resorts the express on the expressway through US sculptures, that the tethering of the crystal astrodomes in the form of the cats and the dogs, defogging the mind's eyes view in the never-ending quest for cheddar. Just call me Mini as the bar is on the horizon for room service. Nervous infections and ticks in the metaphysical landscape.
Metaphysical style.
Reflective imagery burns into the cornea of interdimensional trans-global marketing schemes, loop, dreams, culminating of horizontal posturing, intertwined with sheet music, epic in proportion, enigmatic implosions, inclusive of the masses, I guess metaphysical.
It's a good day.
Kia ora koutou katoa, you're listening to the R1 News Show on the Rāmere R1 News Show here on Radio 1 Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi, and it's currently 11:43. Before on the program, we heard from the New Zealand Education Institute President Liam Rutherford about the struggles facing primary schools in the second wave of COVID-19.
And we now have a pre-recorded interview from the PSGDN in Fiji. In the Cook Islands, same-sex marriage remains illegal under the Crimes Act 1969. Male homosexuality activity can be punishable with up to 7 years imprisonment. Prime Minister of the Cook Islands, Mark Brown, has said after the August election, a review of this Crimes Act will be redrafted so there is no mention of homosexuality as a crime. We spoke with Isikeli Vlavu, CEO of the Pacific Sexual and Gender Diversity Network, about the significance of this announcement and what it means for the future of LGBTQI+ rights in the Pacific. I started by asking what makes this announcement any more significant than previous moves to repeal the anti-homosexuality laws in the Cook Islands?
We think that this is more significant because it is mentioned by the current Prime Minister himself, who is also contesting the next elections. And if he wins, we are going to hold him and his party accountable to his words. So we are holding on to these words, and we will, of course, revisit him should his party wins to follow up on what he had mentioned. And I think this is also the first time that we've heard the Prime Minister mention something about the current efforts that are underway in the Cook Islands to review the criminal code. So we're taking this very seriously, and we are hoping that his party will stick to his words, what he had mentioned before the elections, and work with our affiliates in the Cook Islands to finally decriminalize LGBTQI people in the Cooks.
Are you concerned at all that this is just a bid to gain more votes for the upcoming election, or do you think that change is imminent in the Cook Islands regarding this?
Well, we welcome the PM's intentions, and also the timing of this, and question the timing of this announcement, the PSGDM and its affiliates in the Cook Islands, State TRA Association, and Pride Cook Islands have already been working with and rallying support from various stakeholders, including parliamentary members themselves, some faith-based leaders, and some traditional leaders, to lobby for these legislative changes. And we, of course, with our partners in the Cooks, know that change is indeed imminent. And when we hear our leaders, you know, the current leader making this sort of statement out of the blue, it sort of just cements our drive and motivation to push for these changes.
Under the current laws, could you tell me a bit about what the reality of day-to-day life is for people of the LGBTQI plus community in the Cook Islands?
Yeah, in our conversations with our LGBTQI colleagues and folks in the Cooks, they haven't had any, they haven't gone through any worst scenarios in relation to, you know, LGBTQI people being murdered or being being discriminated or being violated. So most of them continue to live their lives like any other citizen in the Cooks, and they go about their daily life like any other day. Some of them are in casual or stable same-sex relationships with no fear of being prosecuted. So for us, the question then is, why have a law that criminalizes this behavior when already it's generally accepted in the Cook Islands community?
Okay, so given that, why has it taken so long to decriminalize same-sex relations?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it's, I think it's more than 10 years now that we have been having conversations with our affiliates in the Cooks, and them, of course, with government and other various stakeholders in the Cooks to try and decriminalize LGBTQI people. But in our like reflections with our affiliates in the Cooks, we believe that the resistance to change is mainly due to lack of knowledge and understanding and misconceptions around people with diverse sexual orientation and gender identity and expression. And when they sensitize them or provide them the relevant information, it usually opens their minds and hearts, you know, just like with a flick of the fingers. Like they get enlightened by some sort of halo or magic wand when they receive that information. So TTRA Association and the Pride Cook Islands are working around the clock with the gatekeepers, particularly in the faith-based communities, and also in their traditional, like among their traditional leaders, to try and provide them with the relevant information and get them to understand why people of diverse soji are the way they are, and also questioning, you know, their like their allegiance to, you know, the Pacific way, to the Cook Island traditional way of living, and the Cook Island traditional values of love, you know, accepting anyone who's part of your family, regardless of who they are. So they are also using these traditional approaches, and also, you know, questioning the resistance from these gatekeepers by asking, you know, how true they are to upholding these very strong traditional values that are more familiar to them, you know, like respect, love, caring for one another. And these things are very strong, you know, in communal communities like the Pacific communities, including the Cook Islands. So they should not isolate or exclude anyone or treat anyone differently just because they're different from what most of the society are, or what society thinks they should be. And this is why, you know, the TTR Association, Pride Cook Islands, and of course PSGDM needs a lot of resources, give and support from government, from development partners, from donors, and also from the community to assist us in our work of enlightening the community, and basically just sharing with them our lived realities and experiences, and hopefully appeal to them in a way that would change the way they treat and behave and act towards LGBTQI people.
Would a change to anti-homosexuality laws in the Cook Islands see a big impact throughout the Pacific?
Well, it would mean there's one less country for us to focus on in terms of removing those punitive laws. So currently, 7 countries in the Pacific still criminalize LGBTQI people. Cook Islands, Kiribati, PNG, Samoa, Solomon Islands, Tonga, and Tuvalu. So if we were to change the laws in the Cook Islands, we hope that, I mean, this would really motivate and inspire our affiliates in these other countries. We have member affiliates of the PSGDN that are present in the other 6 countries. We hope that they will get motivated to also push and lobby for legislative changes. Our sisters in Tonga, in the Tongalites, our sisters and brothers in the Tongalites Association are already working towards changing the laws. And we hope that this will be sometime soon. And Kiribati, through the support of the Netherlands government and the New Zealand government, Kiribati, Cook Islands, and Tonga, Alites and PNG and Samoa and Tuvalu have also received support from the Netherlands government and the New Zealand government to help them build a movement within the community, the LGBTQ community, and also with allies, feminist movements, the youth movements in their country to then push for these governments to change. To change the law. So this, we're hoping that, you know, once Cook Islands is able to change their laws, that it will motivate other countries to do the same. And we are also doing this within, we're trying to do this work also within the spirit of regionalism. So just last week, we had the Pacific Island Forum leaders here in Fiji, where we were talking about the Pacific 2050 strategy. And also where there was a talk, there was a lot of talk around regionalism. And we often find that when it comes to issues of LGBTQI people, the countries usually want to take a individual approach to it. But for other issues, they usually take a regional approach. But for us, the PSGDN, which is the Regional Network of LGBTQI Organizations, in the Pacific, we're wanting to do this, to take a regional approach to it and to this, and also ready support from all our partners, allies, the UN, and other development partners for us to push our governments to change these laws, because most of them, like I said before, they are there, but they are not enforced. And LGBTQI people are in same-sex, loving same-sex relationships. Some are in casual same-sex relationships. So then why have it as a law if it's just hanging there uselessly? And also, yeah, so like I said, with the spirit of regionalism that has been promoted by our leaders, we hope that, you know, when we do come to them and ask them that, you know, now we only have 7 countries in the Pacific that still criminalize LGBTQI people. We would like to be the first region in the world, you know, where people of diverse SOGI or LGBTQI people can live freely, exercise their full freedoms and rights, reach their full potential, live safe and become prosperous and live healthy lives. So why don't you decriminalize the LGBTQI people?
Kia ora koutou. That was a little pre-recorded interview Amelia had done with Isikeli Vulavu, the CEO of the Pacific Sexual and Gender Diversity Network. That was over, well, talking about the significance of, I guess, legalizing same-sex marriage in the Cook Islands, as it remains an illegal act under the Crimes Act of 1969. My lord, we've had a surprisingly full and plentiful show here on the Ramere R1 News Show. First off, we had business as usual with Trent Smith from the University of Otago Department of Economics, talking about market barriers to entry, their importance, where they can be beneficial, where they can not be so beneficial, and how they are constructed. Are they through government policy? Are they through the natural mechanisms of competition, etc., etc.? After that, we had an interview with the New Zealand Educational Institute President, Liam Rutherford, about how schools are coping under the second wave. It isn't too great, to no one's surprise, as a combination of staff shortages and, you know, the sickness is sweeping through the schools, so to speak. And that, combined with it being winter, has just led to an all-round not great time. The government has recently just introduced mask mandates for year four and above in primary schools, which Liam says is a helpful step, but more could definitely be done in that area. You've been listening to the Rāmere Awa News Show here on Radio 1, Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. It is currently 11:57. I hope you all have a fantastic, fantastic day. Remember to tune in to the Rāmere Awa News every weekday from 11 to 12. That's all I'm going to say. Have a fantastic day. Coming up on the program, or after this, I should say, we have Dane Rumble with Cruel, an absolute Kiwi classic. Stay tuned. Be sure to have a fantastic day. Bye.
You've been tuned in to the R1 News, weekdays from 11 to 12 here on Radio 1 91 FM, Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. Catch up at r1.co.nz/news or find us at Radio 1 91 FM on Twitter or R1 News NZ on Instagram.
That was the Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more at r1.co.nz or wherever quality content is found.